So in a lot of ways, this paper is really related and dovetails a lot with Vasco's work. My paper is titled Manufacturing Revolutions, Industrial Policy and Networks in South Korea. And just taking a step back, this project is really motivated by a desire to revisit the East Asian growth miracle. And if you look at East Asian countries in the late 1950s and early 1960s, if you look at a country like South Korea, they looked like a lot like many least developed countries in that era. Especially if you think of income per capita terms, South Korea ranked along with some sub-Saharan African economies at this time. And so we tend to forget this fact, but what we don't forget is that over the next 20, 30 years, South Korea experienced this rapid industrialization. And so the question in my mind really is, how did South Korea go from being a hopelessly agrarian economy in the 1960s, which had contemporaries like sub-Saharan African economies, how did they go from that to being the manufacturer, the home of manufacturers like Samsung, Daewoo, and things like that? So that's really the guiding question behind this project, and it's an empirical project. It's going to have less theory than any other projects here today. And what I'm going to do to explore this question, or this kind of motivating question, is I'm going to use this policy, I'm going to evaluate this big push type industrial policy. I'm going to look at South Korea's heavy chemical and industry drive, 1973-1979. And I'm going to look at this policy because it really was indicative of and what the policy planners had in mind. They really had a classic big push in mind, the kind of big pushes that original development scholars had thought about in the 1950s, 1940s, and 1960s. I'm going to look at this policy because it really is representative of what many East Asian countries were doing in the post-war period to try to rapidly industrialize. And importantly, what I'm going to try to argue, especially from an economic history perspective, is that this policy was started and ended due to exogenous social forces, and these social forces can maybe be leveraged to estimate the effects and the impacts of industrial policy in a coherent way. And so the really constrained question of this paper is, what is the effect of industrial policy on industrial development, and can we look at these effects and impacts in kind of a granular way? Is that us? Anyways, this is going to touch on kind of a larger existential question, which is, what is the role of a government in producing industrialization and structural change beyond just getting the fundamentals right? And what I'm not going to address, just to manage expectations here, I'm not going to talk about the welfare implications of this policy. I'm going to steer away from aggregate implications of this policy because I'm using within-country variation, and I think to do so might be hazardous with the framework I'm working in. Right? So here's a roadmap of what I'm going to do. I'm going to first look at the direct effects of this policy. This policy is a temporary industrial policy. It's going to target only a discrete set of constrained sectors. What is the impact on this discrete set of constrained sectors, these targeted sectors? Moreover, because Vasco just talked about, because there's an industrial ecosystem going on, because firms and industries trade and sell amongst one another, what are the impacts beyond just the directly targeted industries? What are the network effects of the industrial policy? How does industrial policy spread through input-output linkages in the way that was envisioned by classic development economists like Albert Hirschman and the like? And moreover, because this is a temporary policy, do I see persistent effects of this policy even when the policy is retrenched? And do I see persistent effects of both these direct effects and these network effects? This policy is going to last 6 years. Do I see the lineages of this policy live on? And in kind of doing this empirical exercise, I'm going to touch on kind of a debate in development economics. You have this, on one hand of this debate, you have scholars like Chalmers Johnson, Robert Wade, Alice Amson, people like this, who really argue that industrial policy played a fundamental role in producing the East Asian growth miracle economies and the post-war growth experiences of many developing countries. But on the other hand, you have this set of scholars here who argue that industrial policy did more harm than good, that especially in a context like South Korea, and specifically with this industrial policy I'm looking at, HCI, that this policy actually did more harm than good. And these people can vaguely be grouped together as maybe representing the Washington consensus. And so the problem with this debate is that there's really no empirics either way. That even though industrial policy is used in nearly every developing country, in nearly every developed country, there's really no empirical evidence as to the efficacy of industrial policy. I think that's kind of criminal. There's a couple few empirical studies for developing countries. Some recent job market candidates have addressed this issue. And there's a few empirical studies for developed countries and developing countries. Philippe's paper is...
So you can go China and develop them.
Well, yeah. It's a good point. You have it for China. But I think nonetheless, regardless though, I think it's crazy that there's no empirical literature on the efficacy of industrial policy. I think it's a missing literature. I think it's crazy. I think we ought to take more stabs at it.
That's the one we not Harrison.
Yeah, and Harrison's paper. That's what I'm referring to. The paper where you look at the competition. And there, I mean, besides you and Treffler, I can't really. There's very, very few.
Both of them had the same similar problem. You,
No, it's fine.
Which is to say, it's not only about yes or no, it's how you do it.
Absolutely.
So, because, you see, at Kruger, the other one, it could be that they were pointing the right things.
They were.
On the
they
certain
made
way
points.
To do it.
Yes.
And maybe there is a way to do
yes,
it
absolutely.
More pro-competition, or more pro-skill intensive, like Treffler.
Absolutely.
With the governance, so that was a bit of a problem.
I think
with Treffler and us, was that?
Yes, I think to skip ahead all the way to the end, I think governance is going to be the fundamental role in all this. I'm going to show you things that are relatively trivial, that this policy worked as it was supposed to work, but I think what really underpinned the success of this policy were the political economy factors. So I think to study industrial policy, we have to study political economy. So what specifically I'm going to find is that targeted sectors grow about 80% more than non-targeted sectors. And what I don't find is that this isn't crowding out any other sectors. I'm not estimating a positive effect by virtue of some winners and some losers. Everyone's growing, but some grow more than others. I'm going to find an 80% effect, 80% more growth in targeted versus non-targeted sectors. And importantly, I'm going to find very significant price declines in output for targeted sectors as well, relative to non-targeted sectors. And I'm going to provide some of the first evidence. I'm being cheeky here. Of Albert Hirschman linkage effects. Of course, many people have examined these linkage effects. I'm just going to do it in a difference in difference framework. I'm going to just supply some kind of evidence of these Albert Hirschman linkage effects, and I'm going to make the point that these linkage effects are operating in some very nuanced ways that Albert Hirschman didn't expect, that he didn't talk about. And I'm going to find sectoral persistence of both these things. So here's a roadmap of what I'm going to do. I'm going to first talk about the historical nature of this intervention. I think this is what I'm going to use to motivate my identification strategy in empirics. I'm going to talk about the data exercise, which is very intensive. I'm going to briefly talk about the theory. I'm just going to go over a very simplified conceptual framework that's going to frame the empirics. And I'm going to get to the estimation of the direct effects and network effects. Just for time, I'm going to have to glean over the policy implications of this paper, of this policy. I'll explain what I glean over in a second. But really, you can say the history of this project or this policy really starts with this guy right here, Richard Nixon, who in 1969, following the disaster of the Vietnam War, decides the U.S. has no business being in the Asia-Pacific region. He decides the U.S. is going to pull out of Vietnam. And the U.S. is also going to pull out of the Korean Peninsula. So in 1971, Nixon starts withdrawing a couple thousand troops, or about 20,000 troops from the South Korean Peninsula, from the demilitarized zone, and really promises a full withdrawal of the U.S. military presence by the end of the decade. And for South Korea, this is a real disaster, because at this time, as soon as Nixon's making this announcement, South Korea is growing under, is experiencing increased military threat from North Korea. And at this point, South Korea is actually experiencing a political crisis, because at this time that Nixon's announcing a full troop withdrawal, South Korea is very much convinced that they're going to be invaded by North Korea again. And so this is a security disaster that really throws South Korea into a military and domestic political crisis. And the president of South Korea, this guy right here, Park Chung-hee, he decides to impose a military dictatorship in 1973 because of this troop withdrawal threat and because of all this potential threat of North Korean invasion. He calls a military dictatorship, and the cornerstone of this military dictatorship is a big push for military self-sufficiency. And this big push is, in fact, the big push that I'm going to study in this paper, this heavy chemical and industry drive from, again, it's going to last 1973, 1979. And the goal of this policy will be to shift the economy from a light export economy to a heavy industrial economy that's one day capable of producing domestic arms. And to this day, actually, South Korea is a major arms producer in the world. They won't be at this time, but this was really a project that was meant to grow the supply chain for future military industry. And in doing so, what they're going to do is they're going to target about six strategic sectors. These are broad sectoral categories. And these are going to translate to about 90 ISIC, five-digit industries that's going to underlie these six strategic industries. And so what did this drive do? What did this big push do specifically? What it's going to do, it's going to use kind of two policy levers. It's going to use investment subsidies and trade policy to kind of steer resources to these strategic sectors. And they're going to really lean on the subsidies. They're going to really lean on the investment subsidies, funnel them through the Korean Development Bank, and throw cheap credit at these strategic sectors. But what they're also going to do is they're also going to use trade policy to also steer resources towards these sectors. And what I find in this paper is that instead of actually using a lot of protection, instead of protecting the output markets for the treated sectors, what they're instead going to do is they're going to cut input tariffs for the treated sectors. And I think this is an important point because many people argue that the East Asian industrial policies really relied on protecting output. And when you look at the data, I don't find that's the case. I find what they rather did was they allowed treated sectors, or target sectors, to import things freely without any tariffs, right? And I won't be able to have time to
import inputs, maybe?
Exactly, to import intermediate inputs for essentially freely. So you can think of a couple set of sectors that are enjoying essentially free trade regimes within a sea of protected industries. So this policy is cut short. This policy, again, starts in 1973 with this military dictatorship, and just 6 years after, it's cut short by the assassination of the president at this time, Park Chung-hee, the chief architect of this policy. So he's assassinated by his own intelligence officers at a dinner party. And the big push really ends after this assassination in 1979, and it really starts winding down then. So I'm going to use 1973 and 1979 as proper start and end dates to this big push. And as you'll see, this will be reflected in the data as well. And I argue that all this historical motivation, it's not window dressing, I think it's advantageous. I think it's advantageous for this intervention, to study this intervention, because it means that security drove this policy. And because security and politics were driving this industrial policy, this means that in this case, the industrial targeting is orthogonal to the usual sources of bias that plague estimates of industrial policy. Specifically, what I mean is this is a policy shock that's being imposed top-down by military decree. And it circumvents, I argue, two major sources of bias that kind of pollute empirical studies of industrial policy. On one hand, you have what I call the sunset industry bias. And usually in cross-country studies of industrial policy, you get a negative effect of industrial policy. And that's because in a lot of countries like the UK and in my country, Sweden, you have industrial policies that are being deployed to essentially protect industries that are in decline. And so when you estimate the effect of industrial policy using a large panel of countries, you get this kind of mechanical negative bias between the use of industrial policy and the effect of industrial policy on growth. And that's usually, these things are usually polluted and caught up in estimates of industrial policy. So this will circumvent that. Moreover, this will also circumvent what I call the picking losers bias, or what actually other people like Danny Roderick call the picking losers bias. And what I mean by that is that industrial policy in many developing countries is deployed in completely incoherent ways. Resources are being pumped into sectors due to pure political connection standards. They're being steered into industries that they have no hope in having competitive advantage in. And in this case, South Korea is going to use a very advanced planning apparatus to steer resources into industries that are actually coherent. They're not incoherent. That's a great question. So that means industries that could potentially be competitive with enough capital.
How do you define?
So they had some of their own calculations. But you can think of an industries where, with enough capital, they can be, they have, can have a, their international prices can be such that they can be competitive on the international market. I think that's what they were thinking in their heads. And you can actually see these types of calculations if you crack open the planning data. You can have that. That's kind of what they had in mind. Yeah, they had an idea. So they want to protect strategic industries. They want to be a military powerhouse. They want to have domestic military industrial complex. But they know all the set of strategic industries. Like if I look at the procurement data from his project, you see missiles and nuclear warheads. They realized very early on that they can't produce missiles. They don't have the technologies or any kind of latent comparative advantage of producing missiles. So they're going to use the planning apparatus to kind of limit the scope of sectors with which they target and only target feasible industries. I'm going to call that industries with latent comparative advantage, which I could talk about later. Yeah, no, they were very mindful of increasing returns to scale as well. Yeah. Which you would think with enough capital, you could, the prices decline rather rapidly. Of course, I'm going to avoid talking about increasing returns to scale because in a couple slides I talk about a model with constant returns to scale. But yeah. So one reason why people don't study the East Asian growth miracle is the fact of data constraints. And for many East Asian countries, you have little machine-readable data. You don't really even have firm data at all or plant-level data at all. And most data is in hard copy form and stuck in archives. And so what this project has entailed is kind of a big archival digitization effort where I'm going to combine four different sources of data. The main source of data for this project is going to come from the Korean industrial censuses, which are going to be digitized from a U.S. archive, but they come from a Korean archive too. This is going to be the main source of data. This is going to be just a conventional industrial census thing with outcomes like output, capital, you know, wage bill. Actually, the capital measurements are very, very detailed and very good. It's going to have inventories, material costs, all sorts of things like that. It's going to span 1973 to 1986. So it's going to give me a couple years before the start of the policy. This policy starts in 1973. And it's going to actually go, the panel I'm going to construct is going to go even after the policy is retrenched. So I'm going to look at the effects before and after this policy. And this is going to be a survey that's conducted at the establishment level, but I'm only going to observe industry level aggregates, which are going to preclude me from doing a lot of advanced stuff. So it's going to be a very kind of simple empirical exercise right now. So I'm going to combine this digitized industrial census with mainframe data tapes, the data tape versions of this industrial census that were sold to a US library in the 1980s. So I'm going to combine this digitized data with mainframe data tapes of similar data. And I'm going to rebuild the input-output network for the economy using the input-output accounts for 1970, a pre-treatment year. I'm going to digitize and recreate the input-output accounts for 1970. And these are going to be a pretty reasonable level of granularity, about 340 by 340 sectors. And in addition to this network data, I'm also going to digitize tariff and trade data. And I'm going to observe tariffs that are being applied to these industries, and as well as quantitative restrictions. And this data set was sold to a Swiss graduate student in the 1980s. It's at the product level. I'm going to aggregate this up to the industry level. And I'm going to combine these four sources of data together and create a very rich data set that, again, spans the scope of this policy. I'm going to get a couple pre-treatment years and a set of post-treatment years as well. Right. So before I get to empirics, I'm going to just go over very, very stylized theory. I'm not going to derive actually any of the theory that's used in the paper. I'm just going to use the basic conceptual framework to frame the empirical results that are to come. And the theoretical framework I use in the paper is the standard type of Long-Closter model from 1983, the type of Long-Closter model with N industries that's used by people who study network economics right now, people like Vasco and Asimoglu have used this policy. I forgot that at all there. No. Asimoglu. Wait, are you on this one?
Is it blue?
No.
That's not the same paper.
I should put Vasco's paper on here as well.
Sorry.
But I should put Vasco's paper on here as well.
It's the MDR paper, the macroannual.
This is macroannual paper. But anyways, a lot of macroeconomists are using this to study network economics. And I'm going to use this paper because it really captures the richness of the input-output economy with very, very limited assumptions. And it's going to give me three testable predictions as to the effects of this policy through the input-output space. And you know, it's going to be this economy consists of n perfectly competitive industries. Each industry creates one product with a constant returns to scale technology. These n products are consumed by a representative agent who also has Cobb-Douglas preferences. And each industry is perfectly competitive. Very, very simple. And I'm going to conceptualize industrial policy in terms of wedges. I'm going to think of, you know, you look at this n sector economy. This economy is going to be populated by a bunch of distortions. These distortions are going to act as effective taxes on intermediate inputs and capital. And what a planner is going to do, and what the planning apparatus of South Korea is going to do, it's going to apply subsidies to these sectors, which is going to be tantamount to the planner removing these wedges or removing these taxes on intermediate inputs and capital for the treated industries. So this is just how I'm going to conceptualize industrial policy in this framework. And they're going to simply think of it as the planner removing these two wedges or these two taxes on intermediate inputs and capital for treated industries. And that's how this policy is going to operate in this model. Oh, it always screws up this arrow. So the implications of there's going to be three implications of this policy in general equilibrium. These are the two wedges that are being lowered for a treated industry. We can think of a treated industry like steel, I right here. So you apply these two subsidies to steel, steel output grows. And if you think of a forward-linked sector or a downstream sector like automobiles, a sector that uses steel in its input process, this forward-linked sector will expand because steel is now cheaper. There's an output shock to steel. So that means automobiles have cheaper inputs, and that in turn, automobile industries will expand as well. Right? That's very simple. But again, these two policy levers are going to be applied to steel. What does that mean for the upstream sectors? An upstream sector we can think of it as ore, a sector that's supplying to steel. In a closed economy, with just capital subsidies being applied to steel, steel grows, and in turn that would be a demand boon for the ore industries of this world in a closed economy. But because the government is essentially allowing steel to import inputs freely from abroad, this means steel is expanding and buying more inputs potentially from abroad that might compete with the domestic ore industries of the world. So while the policy is going to be potentially positive for these forward-linked or downstream industries, the automobile manufacturers of the world, this policy might actually create a negative demand shock vis-a-vis import competition to these upstream sectors of the world, to the ore industries of the world. And these are the things I'm going to try to look for in the empirical results. And I merely use this theoretical framework, this conceptual framework, because as you mentioned, you don't have weird things going on through input-output space. You have very clear directionality of the policy effects downstream and upstream. Right. So now for the estimation. So the econometric setting for this policy is going to be very, very simple. I'm merely going to trace the differential evolution of treated versus non-treated sectors before and after the implementation of this policy. Right. So specifically what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a flexible difference in difference estimator. It's very, very simple. I'm going to have a dummy indicator of whether you're targeted or not, a dummy indicator of whether you appear in the government's plan for all the sets of industries that they're choosing to target. You're going to get a 1 or a 0. And this is going to be interactive with a time variable, a time dummy as well. And this is essentially going to estimate the difference at every point in time between treated and non-treated industries for every year relative to 1972, for every year between 1970 and 1986. So I'm essentially going to estimate a difference in difference effect for every year before and after the policy to kind of give you a sense of the dynamics of the implementation and the effects of this policy. Yeah?
I know you don't want to go into wealth, but how is this financed?
It's being financed through a lot of Japanese loans, some World Bank loans. They're being funneled into the Korean Development Bank, but they're really throwing together a bunch of different external,
a lot of deficit
spending. But there is non-trivial amounts of Japanese capital they're going in as well as kind of miscellaneous World Bank loans, much to the World Bank's chagrin.
No increased taxation from final demand? Or?
There's some, but not in serious ways yet. Yeah. So I'm going to estimate this, I'm going to show you this beta coefficient. I'm not going to show you any tables. I'm merely going to plot the dynamic difference and difference effect through time. And this will give you a sense of the effects of the dynamic effects of this policy. So this is an industry level study, so I'm going to include industry level fixed effects, time fixed effects, and I'm going to control flexibly for a bunch of pre-treatment characteristics for each industry that I think might be correlated with unobserved productivity changes. And these are going to all be interacted with time dummies as well. So what I would usually do here is show you the effects of these policies, right? I'm telling you that there's two policies that are being used by the planner. The planner is using investment subsidies and trade policy to steer resources to these sectors. And what I would usually do at this point is show you what are the policy effects of this. Do you actually see that these policies are binding? Do you see investment subsidies and investment responses by firms vis-a-vis this policy going on? And you see input subsidies changing as well. I do find that in the paper. You do observe that massive increases in capital investment in equipment, things like that. And I show you that indeed input tariffs and quantitative restrictions are being really, really cut severely for treated industries versus non-treated industries. And where you don't see an effect, you don't see that they're increasing protection on the output of these treated industries. So really where you see the action is cutting of tariffs and the subsidizing of capital goods. Yep. I know. But I won't have time to get into that. But I don't think that's a non-trivial thing. I don't think looking at policy is just, it's not window dressing. Because I think a lot of times when you're implementing industrial policy in developing countries, you actually won't find any effects here at all. You actually won't observe, a lot of that capital might be consumed, it might find its way into Swiss bank accounts. At this time, the Philippines was pursuing similar industrial policy, and surely a lot of the capital subsidies that went to treated industries went straight to, like, you know, the consumption of status goods and went to building Imelda Marcos's shoe collection and things like that. So I don't think it's a non-trivial thing, but I won't have time to get into it. What I'm going to instead do is look at the direct effects of the policy. I'm going to look at, does this policy indeed cause differential growth in treated versus non-treated sectors? Again, these two policies are binding. Do you see that there's going to be growth in these treated sectors? And a lot of people, there's a huge literature, an older literature in development, which argued that there actually weren't many positive effects of this industrial policy. But indeed, what I find is that this industrial policy had some very positive effects on industrial output for treated relative non-treated sectors. See, value shipments, that's my measure of output, but I can use things like gross output or value added. Output dramatically increases for treated industries relative non-treated industries. This is these are the betas from the difference in difference regressions I showed you before. I'm merely plotting the differences. And there's little evidence of pre-trends. The policy kicks into place right after the policy announcement, and growth starts almost immediately, almost following the next year. And there's sustained growth all up into the assassination of Park Chung-hee. But even after the policies start to be retrenched, you still see these sectors are different, producing more than other sectors. So there's some evidence of persistence even after this assassination occurs, and even after these policies are retrenched. And these things show up in measures like labor productivity as well. But this might not all be that convincing because, as I told you, they're investing a lot in capital. So mechanically, you might just have labor productivity increasing. But on the other hand, what's really interesting is that you see things like output prices decline very, very rapidly for treated versus non-treated industries. You see that there might be some evidence of some pre-trends here, but really I think what the kicker is, you see output prices deeply, deeply falling for treated versus non-treated industries. So industrial policy is rapidly reducing the price of things like steel, and things that are being used in other manufacturing of other products in the economy. I think this is important because I think it's documented that this actually isn't the case when you use industrial policy in many countries. So you aren't getting this price effect. And here you're getting this price effect. And the source of this price effect, I need to dig into this a little more, but I actually have some results that might suggest that this might be being driven by productivity gains as well. So to show you these things, I want to get to the network effects now. I want to see if the steel industries of the world are growing, if these treated industries are, yeah, 5 minutes? Okay. What are the network effects of this policy? How are these price effects percolating through the economy? And really the point, what I'm going to do empirically here is essentially compare industries that are differentially linked in the input-output space to the treated industries. So industries, I'm going to look at the black industries that are differentially connected to the red targeted industries right here. This is just the 1970s input-output network for the South Korean economy plotted. So I'm going to build a measure for four linkages, which is just going to encompass basically the share. You think of a downstream sector like automobiles, a four-link sector. The degree to which they're exposed to the policy is going to be reflected in this forward linkage measure, which is simply a reflection of the share of I's inputs that are being purchased from treated industries. And conversely, I'm going to have a backward linkage measure, which is merely going to be a measure for the war industries of the world or the downstream or the upstream sectors of the world. And this is going to essentially reflect the degree to which ore's output is being sold. Ore's total output, the share of ore's total output that's being sold to treated industries. And these are going to capture the direct linkages from industries to the treated industries, from external industries to the treated industries. But as you alluded to in your study, as Vasco had alluded to, you know, these are just one degree connections to the treated industries. There might be n degree linkage effects from a treated industry to a connected industry. That is, you might have an ore industry of the world. You have the targeted steel industries of the world, or it's affected directly by what's happening in the steel industry, but they might be affected through a whole bunch of intermediary sectors and connections that are also occurring throughout the economy. So I want a measure that captures the total linkage effects between the treated industries and the non-treated industries, the networked industries. I'm simply going to appeal to the Leontief inverse, and I'm going to build essentially total linkage parables to these direct linkage measures, which I constructed before, right? These are going to be constructed vis-a-vis the Leontief inverse of the input-output tables, which were used to construct the direct forward and backward linkages. Right? And so recall the two predictions from the model. I had the backward-linked industries, the downstream industries of the world. There might be an ambiguous effect of this policy because this policy is introducing a bunch of import competition to the downstream, to the upstream industries of the world, to the ore manufacturers of the world. That they might be exposed to import competition from abroad because steel is now being allowed to import a lot of ore from abroad. And at the same time, I have this other prediction, prediction two, which says that steel grows, and steel growing is going to be a positive boon for the forward link to the downstream sectors, the automobile industries of the world, who are going to benefit from having cheaper prices and things like that. Indeed, if I look at the forward linkage linked firms relative to the unlinked firms, I see there's a lot of noise before the treatment effect occurs, before treatment. I see that forward linked industries grow a ton, a lot. They grow substantially during the policy, as is during the policy period, and that these positive effects kind of linger even after the policy is retrenched. So I see that there's these essentially positive forward linkage effects. So the automobile industries are certainly growing as a result of this policy. And I argue that they're growing, and the reason why they're growing is their input prices are lower, and in turn their output prices are lower. They're buying more inputs, domestically produced inputs. They're buying domestic capital, all of which are now cheaper, and this is causing them to grow, and it's also causing them to have cheaper output. So that price decrease I showed you that's occurring in the treated sectors, this is being transmitted to the automobile industries of the world. So the price decline in one sector is leading to a price decline in these forward link sectors. And this is a pretty robust finding in the paper. So as for backward link sectors, they indeed show that the ore industries of the world are essentially suffering. Those are those that are most connected to the treated industries through backward linkages are indeed declining much through the policy period. And they keep declining even after the policy is retrenched. If I use a total linkage measure, this effect is a bit attenuated. There might be positive spillovers that are also kind of benefiting these backward-linked industries. But indeed, you see this kind of negative direct effect on these backward-linked industries. So they seem to be indeed suffering. And I show that they're indeed suffering because they're being exposed to import competition. That is, if you look at the degree to which the economy is importing goods from abroad, backward-linked goods from abroad, Before the industrial policy is in place, you see there's no connection between the backward linkage strength and the value of inputs. But you see, during the implementation of the policy, essentially these treated industries are importing a lot of these backward-linked goods from abroad, and these are in turn causing a decline in output from these ore industries of the world. So you could really think of the net effect as if you have these steel industries, the target industries are growing, they're reaping the benefits of this industrial policy. The forward-linked sectors, they're reaping a bunch of benefits of this industrial policy. They're growing in turn. These are the automobile industries of the world. And essentially, on net, the kind of more primitive, the more upstream ore industries of the world, they're essentially being sacrificed so that South Korea can kind of move up the supply chain vis-a-vis this industrial policy. So if you put kind of gather all these facts together, this is this kind of movement up the supply chain is the kind of image that one gets insofar as the effects of this industrial policy. How am I doing with time? Zero? Okay. That's basically the gist of this policy. But one thing I want to say before I end is that the more you look into industrial policy, the more you see that the effects of this industrial policy are almost trivial. What really mattered for this industrial policy working, I think, is the political economy. And that's the next step for this.